Revolver spoke to the north-west-south rapidly, the nose of it jerking at each explosion. The first two rabbits skidded along the earth dead. The one to the south leaped high into the air, and that pitiful, half-human shriek which only a stricken hare utters sounded to the ears of Cameron. The pain of that jerked the head of Cameron to the side. Then his fifth shot accurately smashed the backbone of the jackrabbit from end to end. Before Cameron moved again, halted as he was in mid-stride, he rapidly reloaded the Colt. It seemed a single uninterrupted gesture that jammed the five cartridges into the chambers. When the cylinder was filled again, Cameron picked up the game, cleaned it, tied it in a bleeding bundle for the return trip, and then stood straight once more to scan the horizon. A fox or a wolf will do this after the flurry of the fight, when there is dead game to be eaten, a last look towards all possible danger before the feeding begins, and never a wolf had eyes brighter than those of Cameron. It was during this rapid scanning of the whole circle of the twilight that he saw the glimmer on the head of the mountain, up there between the ears of the height, where stood his and Wayland's mine. That trembling gleam could be but one thing, the shimmer of flame. The shack was on fire. In some way, it was inconceivable. Mark Wayland had permitted the cabin to become ignited. Once the fire caught on the wood, with no water available for the fight, there was nothing to do but shovel earth at the flames. And perhaps the fire would spread into the shaft and burn the timbers. The shaft would collapse. The labor of the many months would be undone, just as they were sinking into the valuable heart of the vein, just as they were writing the preface to a wealthy life, an easy future divorced from the need of labor, of sweat, and worry. Cameron, through the space needed for one long breath, thought of these things. Then he stripped the ragged shirt from his back, wrapped the precious meat in it, and slinging the shirt around his shoulders like a knapsack, he began to run. He ran with his eye on the flame-spotted head of the mountain. As for the roughness of the terrain, his feet could see their own way. The half-Indian blood of his mother gave him that talent. Like an Indian, he toed in slightly, his body erect in spite of the weight on his back, his breathing deep and easy, an effortless spring in his stride. There was something of the deer about him, something of the predatory wild beast also. He would catch his game, if not at the first spring, then by wearing it down. When it was caught, he would know how to kill, for if he had the body and the darkened skin of an Indian, he had the proud features of the white man, and the white man has always lived by blood. When he came to the end of the valley, he started up the ascent of the trailless slope with a shortened step. The small weight of the rabbit meat was beginning to tell on him now. The burning of his lungs, the trembling exhaustion of effort, the agony of labor was stamped in the heaving for breath and in his shuddering belly muscles. But it appeared only as a slight shadow on his face in the sweat that polished the bronze of his body. So he came to the upper level, the head of the elevation where he and Mark Wayland had found the thin streak of color long ago, and had begun their mine. He had brighter light than that of the dusk now. It came from the ruins of the cabin, weltering with flame, and out of the throat of the mine shaft issued a boiling mist of flame and smoke. The cabin was gone. The labor on the shaft was ruined also. Well, all of this could be reformed, redone. They had the plunder which 3 weeks of work in the heart of the vein had put into their hands, 50 pounds of gold dust. Perhaps it would be wiser anyway to take the money to town, turn part of it into hired labor, tools, powder, mules, and return to reopen the work with tenfold more advantage. He thought of that as he stood on the edge of the little plateau and saw the flames. The fire made little difference, but where was the figure that he had imagined hard at work shoveling earth? Where was Mark Wayland? Where was that big, stocky body, that resolute face? "Mark!" he shouted. "Mark! Oh, Mark!" He had no answer. A dreadful surmise rushed into Cameron's mind, a sort of darkness, a storm across the soul. He ran forward past the mouth of the mine, past the crumbling, flame-eaten timbers of the hoist, towards the fiery shambles of the cabin. It had fallen in heaps. The fire was rotting the heaps away. Smoldering, charred logs lay here and there where they had rolled from the shack. A more irregular shape was stretched on the ground, smoking. He had passed it when something more profound than the sight of the eyes stopped him. He turned back to that twisted shape and leaned over the body of Mark Wayland. Strong wires had been twisted around the arms, fastening them helplessly to the sides. The legs had been wired together at the knees and also at the ankles. There was a gag crammed into the mouth, distending it wide. Fire had eaten the body. Someone had come, caught Mark Wayland by surprise, robbed the cabin, bound the victim, and trusted to the fire to rub out the record of the crime, and then Cameron saw that the eyes of the dead man were living. A cry came from Cameron like the scream of a bird. He snatched the gag from the mouth of Wayland. He picked up the great smoking hulk of the body in his arms to carry it to the life-giving waters of the creek. The voice of Wayland stopped him. The voice was calm. "I'm dead," said he. "I'm already in hell. Don't waste motions. Listen to me." Cameron laid his burden back on the ground. He broke the wires that bound the captive. With his bare hands he stopped the red coals of fire that ate at the clothes of the victim. "A gray mustang," gasped Wayland. "He was riding a gray mustang with a lopped ear, lopped left ear. A big man. Give me that gun."
"No, Mark," shouted Cameron. "I'll take care of you. I'll make you well."
"God," gritted Wayland. "Don't you see that I'm burned to the bone? My face'll rub away like rot." And again added, half sobbing, "Give me that gun. A big kind of man, a gray mustang, a Roman nose and a lopped left ear."
"Mark, you've been a father. For God's sake, let me be a son to you now. Let me try."
"Are you going to show yourself a damned half-breed after all?" demanded Mark Wayland. "Give me that gun." Cameron was stiffened upright on his knees by the insult, but he drew out the revolver and dropped it on the ground. He whirled to his feet and began to run. He realized that he could not run beyond the sound of the gunshot, and cast himself down on his face with his hands clapped over his ears. But he heard, nevertheless. It seemed as though the noise were conducted to him through the earth. His body drank it in, not through the ears only, but through every nerve. It was a deep, short, hollow, barking noise, and it meant that Mark Wayland was dead. It meant that the years were struck away from Wayland. It meant that the years he had spent in rearing and caring for the outcast Cameron could never be repaid, nor that patience and teaching which had endowed Cameron with far more than his preceptor had ever known. The whole future was snatched away from Cameron, the whole chance of making a return to his benefactor, and all the love that he had poured out towards Wayland would now have no object. It would blow away in the wind. It would be wasted on a ghost. Cameron lay still on the ground. But there was one thing to live for. There was the man, the big sort of man, who rode the gray mustang with a lopped left ear. Cameron got up from the earth as a cat rises from sleep at the scent of prey. The trail could not be followed by night. Cameron spent the darkness in digging the grave. He carried to the grave the dead man with the flame-eaten body and the purple-rimmed hole in the right forehead. Into the pit he lowered the dead man. Over the body he first laid with his hollowed hands a layer of brush, because he could not endure the thought of rocks and earth pressing even on the dead face. Afterwards he filled the grave. He wanted some sort of ceremony. Instead, he could only give his own voice, and his own voice was too small for the moment. It could not fill the vast space of the mountains and the desert which the dawn was beginning to reveal. Therefore, as he kneeled by the grave, Cameron merely lifted to the morning in the east his empty hands and made a silent vow. Afterwards he took the revolver and went on the trail. There were only 5 bullets in that revolver now, but he had enough rabbit's meat to last him for a time. He followed the trail across the desert. It took him 3 days to get to the hills and to the town of Gallup. There the sign disappeared. But if he ever found the trail of that horse again, he would know it. He would know it by the length of the stride in walking, trotting, galloping. He would know it by the size of the hoof prints. The only description he had of the rider was of a big sort of man, and Gallup Town was filled with big sort of men. Therefore he left the town and cut for sign in circles around it. Every day he made the circuit until at last, on the old desert trail, he found what he was looking for. He had not been able to spot the gray horse in Gallup, but he had found the trail of it leading from the place. 2 days he ran down that trail, for the rider traveled fast. For 2 days the flesh melted from the body of Cameron as he struggled along the traces of the unknown. At the end of the 2nd day he saw a winking fire in a patch of mesquite beside an alkali waterhole. He crawled to that fire on his belly like a snake and saw standing nearby, eating from a nose bag, a gray mustang with a Roman nose, a dirty gray mustang with a yellow stain in the unspotted portion of its hide, and its left ear was lopped off 1 inch from the point. By the fire sat a big man with a broad red face and red hair. When Cameron looked at him, he smiled and took a deep breath. The weariness of the 2 days of running slipped from his body. The tremor of exhaustion passed away from his nerves. His hands became quiet and sure. Then he stood up on the edge of the firelight. "Put up your hands," said Cameron. The red-faced man looked up with a laugh. "You won't be getting anything off of me except a horse and a half a side of bacon, brother," he said. "What's the matter?" "Stand up," commanded Cameron. The red-faced man grunted. "Ah, well," he said, and he rose to his feet. "You've got a gun on your hip," said Cameron. "Use it." "What's the matter?" shouted the other. "My God, you ain't gonna murder me, are you?" Fear rounded his eyes. He looked like a pig, soggy with fat for the market. A horror surged up in Cameron when he thought that this was the man who had killed Mark Wayland, as well conceive of a grizzly slain by a swine. "Look," said Cameron, "I'll give you a fair chance. I'm putting my gun up, and we'll take an even start." This chivalry was not wasted. The man who looked like a pig snatched his own weapon out, suddenly, and started fanning it at Cameron with the flick of a very expert thumb. He should have crashed at least one bullet through the brain of Cameron, except that instinct was as keen as a wolf in him always. It told his feet what to do, and as he sidestepped, he whipped out his own gun. If he could kill three scattering rabbits on the run, he could kill one red-faced swine that was standing still. Cameron drove a bullet for the middle of the breast. It clanged on metal instead of thudding like a fist against flesh. The revolver, jerked out of the fat fingers, was hurled back into the red face. The big fellow made two or three running steps backwards, gripped at the stars with both hands, and fell on his back. Cameron picked up the fallen gun. It was whole. "Here," he commanded, "take up that gun and we'll start again." The other pushed himself up on his hands. There was a bump rising on his forehead, but otherwise he had not been hurt. "Who are you?" "My name is Cameron. Stand up."
"I ain't a-gonna stand up. God Almighty saved my life once tonight, but he won't save it twice. Cameron, I never done you any harm. Why are you after me?"
"You've done me more harm than any other man can ever do," exclaimed Cameron. He came a little closer, drawn by his anger. Hatred pulled the skin of his face taut. "When you did your murder, when you wired him into a bundle and left him to burn in the cabin, you didn't know that he'd managed to wriggle out of the fire and live long enough to put me on your trail, but—"
"Wired into a bundle? Burn in the cabin? What are you talking about, Cameron? I never killed a man in my life."
"What's your name?"
"Jess Carey."
"Carey, tell me where you got the gray horse."
"From Terry Wilson, back there in Gallup."
"What sort of looking man is Wilson?" "Big sort of feller." Surety that he was hearing the truth struck home in the brain of Cameron like the bell-clapper against bronze. He began to tremble. It was as though God had indeed turned the bullet from the heart of Jess Carey, and only for that reason were the hands of Cameron clean. Back there in the town of Gallup, a big fellow by the name of Terry Wilson, a man who had been anxious to sell the gray horse, that was the murderer of Mark Wayland. Cameron backed off into the darkness. He had a last picture of Jess Carey glowering hopelessly after him from the small, ragged circle of the firelight. Then he turned and struck back through the night. There was Big Terry Wilson to be reached, but Terry Wilson was a known name in Gallup, it appeared, and men whose names are known are easily found. Terry Wilson would have to die, and then some peace would come to the tormented ghost of Mark Wayland. This thought soothed the soul of the hunter. During the last 2 days he had made great exertions following the trail of Jess Carey. So when he reached a run of water in the hills at the edge of the desert, he stopped the swinging dog-trot with which he covered ground and lay down to rest. Infinite fatigue made the earth a soft bed. As for the hunger which consumed him, a notch taken up in his belt quieted that appetite. In a moment he was sound asleep. He had 5 hours of rest by dawn. Fatigue still clouded his brain, so he stripped, swam in a pool of the stream, whipped the water from his brown body, and then ran in a circle until his skin was dry. After that he dressed and ran on towards Gallup with the same effortless pace which always drifted him over the trail. A jackrabbit rose from nothingness and dissolved itself with speed. He tipped it over with a snap shot, and ate half-roasted meat sitting on his heels at a hot, smokeless fire of dry twigs. Afterwards he lay flat for 20 minutes, sleeping, and then rose to run as lightly as ever towards Gallup. That night he slept 3 hours, ran on again, and entered Gallup in the early morning when life was beginning to stir. He had 2 bullets left in his gun, but 2 bullets would be enough. The blacksmith had the doors of his shop open and was starting a fire in his forge. "Terry Wilson, can you tell me where I can find him?" asked Cameron. The blacksmith looked up from the gloom of the shop.
"Terry Wilson? Sure, he's got the corral at the end of town. He's the horse dealer."
The horse dealer? The lightness went out of the step of Cameron as he turned away. He had thought that vengeance was about to fill his hand. Instead, it was probable that Wilson was only another milestone pointing down the trail of the manhunt. He reached the corrals of the horse dealer in time to see a new herd driven through the gates of the largest enclosure. They washed around the lofty fences like water around the lip of a bowl. Dust rose in columns, a signal smoke against the sky. Dust spilled outwards in billows, and in that mist Cameron found a big fellow who was pointed out to him.
"Mr. Wilson," he said, "you sold a lop-eared gray to Jess Carey, didn't you?"
The man turned his eye from the contemplation of the horses.
"Jess sticky with that no-account mustang?" he asked.
"Where did you buy the gray?" asked Cameron.
"Tierney," answered Terry Wilson. "Will Tierney."
His eye changed as he stared at Cameron.
"Ain't you Mark Whalen's breed?" he demanded.
The question stiffened the spine of Cameron to ice. Something broke in his brain and a mist of red clouded his eyes. He had to force himself to turn on his heel slowly and walk away. It was not the first time he had heard the word. Breed, usually, or half-breed in full, slurring from life of men with no friendliness for any part of Cameron's heritage. Was it always to strike at him like poison in his shadow? And why? He could wish that he had not led such a secluded life with Mark Whalen, riding, shooting, working as hard as any man, and then in the evening stretching out beside the campfire with one of Whalen's books. He knew something of grammar and books, he knew the wilderness, but he knew nothing of men. Of the human world he had had only a few score glimpses as he passed through with Mark Whalen, and now it seemed that the strange insult of the word breed was to be cast in his face from every side. But why? His mother's mother had been a beauty of the Blackfoot tribe, a queen of her kind. Was there not honor in such blood? And a chieftain of the frontier had married her. Was not their daughter able to hold up her head even before thrones? Three parts of his blood were white, and as for the other part, he could see in it nothing but glory. Yet the world called him breed, as it might have called him cur. Will Tierney was asleep at the hotel.
"I'll go and wake him," said Cameron.
"The hell you will," answered the hotel clerk. "He'll take your skin off if you wake him up before noon. Tierney ain't a gent to fool with. I guess you know that."
Cameron left the lobby. He could wait till noon easily enough. Behind him, his acute ear caught the phrase.
"That's a breed, ain't it?"
"Yeah, walks like one."
Why? What was the matter with his walk? Had Mark Whalen kept him purposely in the wilderness during those long prospecting trips so that his skin would be tough before he was exposed to the tongue of the world? He found a tree in the little plaza opposite the hotel and sat on his heels to smoke a cigarette and think. Sun was filling the world. Over the roof of the hotel he could look up the gorge of Champion Creek and see the white dazzle of the cliffs on its western side. There was beauty and peace to be found, but where white men moved in numbers, there was insult and cruelty. The morning wore away. The sun climbed. The heat increased. A magnificent fellow came down the steps of the hotel and strode along the street. There was a flash and a glory about him. He had that distinction of face which is recognized even at a distance. He bore himself with the pride of a champion, and if his blue silk shirt and silver conchos down his trousers and glint of Mexican wheelwork around his sombrero made a rather gaudy effect, it would be forgiven as the sheen of a real splendor of nature. So that was Will Tierney. Cameron could have wished the name on a fellow of a different aspect, but nevertheless he would have to accost the handsome, swaggering giant. He was up and after him instantly and followed him through the swing doors of Grady's saloon on the corner. A dozen men were inside breathing the cool of the place and the aroma of beer and the sour of whiskey.
"Step up, boys," Tierney was saying. "Line up. It's on me."
A trampling of feet brought everyone towards the bar as Cameron stepped to the shoulder of Tierney and said, "Mr. Tierney, you sold a lop-eared gray mustang to Terry Wilson. Do you mind telling me where you got the horse?" Tierney turned with a sudden jerk. His upper lip pulled back in a sneer that showed the white of his teeth. His eyes were the black of a night that is polished by the stars. He gave to Cameron one glance and then nodded to the bartender.
"Grady, since when have you been letting breeds drink in your place?"
The bartender grunted as though he had been kicked in the stomach.
"Is that a breed? By God, it is. Throw him out. Get out, you damn greaser."
A bow-legged cowpuncher with a bulldog face and neck shook a fist under the chin of Cameron.
"That means you. Get," he growled.
Tierney stood back against the bar with one hand on his hip, the other dangling close to the butt of a revolver that was strapped to his thigh. He was laughing.
"You, Tierney, it's you that I want to talk to," exclaimed Cameron. "Where did you get that gray horse? Will you answer me that? It's a fair question."
"Grady," said Tierney, "do I have to talk to the greasers you keep in your place?"
The cowpuncher with the face of a bulldog drove a big fist straight at the head of Cameron. His punch smote thin air as Cameron dodged, right into the sway of another powerful blow. There were a dozen enemies all bearing down. He tried to shift through them. Hands caught at him, fingers ground into his writhing flesh like blunt teeth. His gun was snatched away. A swinging Colt clipped the side of his head and half-stunned him. Then he was through the swinging doors. The sunlight along the street was like a river of white fire that flowed into his bewildered brain. Hands thrust him forward. He was kicked brutally from behind and pitched on face and hands into the burning dust of the street.
"Where's a whip?" called the clear, ringing voice of Tierney. "We'll put a quirt on the breed dog."
A whiplash cut across the back of Cameron and brought him swiftly to his feet in time to take another lash across his shoulder and breast. Then a rider plunged between him and the Grady crowd. The horse was skidded to a halt. A girl's voice shouted,
"What a crew of cowards you are! A dozen of you on one man! A dozen of you! Will Tierney, isn't there any shame in you? Jack, Tom Culbert, Harry, I'll remember that you were all in this!"
They scattered before her words as before bullets. Two or three hurried down the street. The rest streamed back through the swing doors of Grady's saloon. Their shouted laughter beat on the brain of Cameron. He had dragged off his ragged hat and looked into the gray eyes and the brown, serious face of the girl. She wore a blouse of faded khaki, a well-battered, divided riding skirt of the same stuff. But every inch of the horse she rode spoke of money. That was not what mattered. The thing she had done talked big in the mind of Cameron. And it seemed to him that he could look into the beauty of her face as far and as deep as into the loneliness of a summer evening in the mountains.
"It was rotten of them," the girl flared. "I don't care what you were doing. It's rotten for a dozen men to pick on one."
He put his hand over his shoulder and tentatively felt the welt which the whiplash had left. It was still burning and growing. He could feel it easily through his shirt. "I was asking a question of one of them, and they didn't want me in there, so..." He made a quick gesture. "So they threw me out," he said, and in trying to cover his expression of rage, he smiled.
"Ah," said the girl, "the drunken hoodlums. I'm Jacqueline Payton. Who are you?"
"John Cameron," said he.
"Cameron's a good name. I like it," she said. "I like you, too. I like the look of you, John Cameron. Are you down and out?"
"I've been down just now," he answered. He turned his head and looked steadfastly at the door of the saloon. "I'll be up again, though, perhaps."
"You want to go back in there and fight them? Don't be crazy," she commanded. "You come along with me. Dad needs a new man or two. He'll give you a job. You come along with me."
She dismounted. She touched his arm, and his eyes drew down from the picture of the vengeance which had been growing across his mind.
"Yes, I'll go a ways with you," he said. "You get on the horse again." "I don't ride when a friend is walking," she answered. "Come along, John Cameron."
He walked beside her down the middle of the street. She was not very tall. Her forehead would touch his chin just about. That, it appeared, was the right height. She was not heavy, and she was not light, except in the quick grace of her movements. She had a voice that he must have heard before. He said that aloud.
"Have I heard you speak before today?"
"I don't know. I'm pretty noisy. I do a lot of talking," she smiled. "Have you been around this town?"
"No," he answered, "but it seems as though I've heard your voice before. The sound of it strikes in a certain place and makes echoes. It makes me happy."
She slowed her step and looked up at him with a frown.
"Are you saying that just for my benefit because you think it sounds nicely?" she demanded.
"Are you angry?" asked Cameron. "I'm sorry."
"I guess you mean it all right," she decided aloud. "But just for a minute I wondered. Well, let it go. What are you doing in town, John Cameron?"
"I'm looking for a man, and I think I've found him," said he.
"Is that good news or bad news for him?" asked the girl.
"I have to kill him," said Cameron slowly.
She looked suddenly up at him again.
"Shouldn't I have said that?" he asked her.
"Great Scott, John," she answered. "Do you mean that you're out on a blood trail? You, at your age?"
"I'm 22," he said.
"And going to kill a man? Why, John?"
"Because he murdered my friend," said Cameron.
"Murdered? But there's the law. You can't,
He lifted his hands and looked down at them curiously. "If the law hanged him, there would be nothing that filled my hands. There would be no feeling. There would be no taste, said Cameron, gently.
Good heavens, said the girl. You do mean it.
You're angry, said Cameron, and that makes me unhappy.
Not angry, but horrified. Really, on a blood trail, are you sure that your friend was murdered?
He was tied with wire and left in a burning cabin, said Cameron, and I came back before he was dead. They were beyond the edge of the town. The girl halted, looking straight up into the eyes of Cameron, but he was staring past her at the vision from the past. He lived long enough to tell me what sort of horse the murderer rode. He told me that, and then he asked me for my gun. Then he killed himself.
No, cried the girl. No, 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 it isn't possible that you gave him the gun and let him kill himself.
He was burned, said Cameron, until his face was loose with cooking. It was ready to rub away. He was burned like a roast on a spit. That was why I gave him the gun, before he had to begin screaming with pain.
Oh, I'm sorry.
For the girl, making an odd bubbling noise in the back of her throat, had slumped suddenly against the shoulder of the horse. He could not tell what to do, but the sight of her helplessness made him feel strangely helpless also. He touched her with his hands and his eyes reverently, and this reverence seemed to restore her strength. She was able to stand straight again. The mare turned her head inquisitively toward the mistress and was pushed away by a touch that was also a caress. The path for the girl's mind had been cleared of everything else so that she could stare at the problem of Cameron.
"That is what I saw in your face?" she demanded.
"What else could I do?" asked Cameron.
"I don't know. I only know it was terrible. I never heard of anything so terrible. It makes me want to help you. How can I help you, John?"
"By letting me come to you whenever you're in trouble, whenever you need any sort of help. By letting me walk up the road with you."
"Walk up the road?" she repeated, bewildered. "This is the happiest thing I've ever done," he answered.
"Walking up this road with you, I mean." At this, her eyes avoided him, and her color grew warmer.
"That was a wrong thing to say. I've hurt you by saying that," he declared. "No," she said. "It's not the wrong thing to say, John. I don't think you could say the wrong thing."
He felt his face grow hot. He swallowed and said after a moment of silence, "I haven't seen very much of people, and I don't know how to talk." He walked on beside her. "But is this a happiness for you, too?"
"Yes."
"As though when the road climbed that hill we'd find something wonderful on the other side of it?" She laughed. "A sort of road through the sky?" she said.
"Exactly that. How did you happen to think of that? How did you know what I was thinking?" "I don't know. It's strange," she said.
He began to laugh, and he laughed with her, and their voices made together a music of two parts, high and deep, but with only one theme. He was aware of that. It delighted him, and it delighted her also. Their laughter stopped, and they looked at one another with shining eyes. But still they were walking on, and at this moment they passed the top of the hill beyond which, he had said, they might find that the road was laid through the sky. What they saw was a string of a dozen or more Indians riding across the main trail, blanketed Indians who only lacked feathers in their hair to give them the exact look of the old days. They crossed into the trees and were gone.
"I knew we'd see something strange," said the girl. "They're heading up towards the new reservation."
Something had stirred in the heart of Cameron, and he looked earnestly after the vanished file of riders. But now a turn of the trail brought them to the Peyton ranch suddenly. The confusion of the big corrals, a grove of cottonwoods, and the low, broad forehead of the house itself showing over the rim of the rise. Her father would be inside, she said. She gave her mare to a boy who loitered near the hitching rack and took Cameron straight into the house. He hung back.
"What's the matter?" she asked. "My clothes are ragged. They're dusty and dirty." "Your skin is clean, and so are your eyes. That's what counts. You come along in, and don't be afraid of anything. Father needs a man like you on the place."
The living room was a big barn-like place where a dance or a meeting could have been held. Over in a corner, in a leather chair, sprawled a man with gray hair and a grayish, careworn face. He looked up from some papers spread out before him and rumbled,
"Well, Jack, what have you brought home?"
"John Cameron," said the girl. "And he's a lot to bring. He wants a job, and you'll give him a place. You need him."
Peyton smiled a little.
"You know how these doggone girls are, don't you?" he asked. "The newest dress and the newest man are the only things that count."
Cameron did not smile. He was too seriously and deeply examining the fatherly kindness of that face.
"I want men who can ride and shoot," said Peyton.
We have some rough horses and some pretty handy gents in long loops that have been helping themselves to the herds. They got one of our own men last week. Can you ride and shoot?"
Cameron laughed. With Mark Wayland, he never had had horseflesh to ride unless it were wild-caught, fiercely savage, vengeful, and cruel.
"Yes, I can ride," he said. "I can shoot pretty well, too."
"Good with a rope?"
"I never had one in my hand," said Cameron. "But I can learn."
"Yeah," growled Peyton. "Boys can learn how to handle a rope, but only God can teach them to shoot fast and straight. Let me see how good you can shoot. Here, come over to this window. Got a gun on you?"
"No."
"Take this. Look yonder. You see that crow on top of that fence? Knock him off of it."
"It's not fair, Dad," exclaimed the girl.
"Sure it ain't fair," said Peyton. "But there's nothing any closer for him to blaze away at."
He passed his gun to Cameron, and they saw him stand a little straighter, with his head raised in a peculiar pride and eagerness. Many unfortunate men were to learn the meaning of that lifting of the head before the end of his trail. He gave to the target a single glance. His hand swept up, bearing the flash of the gun. The nose of it jerked as the weapon exploded. The crow leaped from the fence post and swung into the air.
"Missed," said Peyton.
"Try again," cried the girl. "It was a close one."
"It will fall," said Cameron calmly. "It's dying on the wing."
Peyton shrugged. "What makes you think you hit it? No feathers flew."
"I always know when the bullet strikes," said Cameron.
"What tells you?" scowled Peyton.
"I can't say, but I know." Peyton glared at the girl, and she shrugged her shoulders as she answered the glance. This sort of calm egotism was not to her taste any more than it was to the taste of her father. But now Peyton exclaimed,
"By thunder, look!"
The crow, flapping hard, circling for height, seemed to fall suddenly from the edge of his invisible tower in the sky. Down he came, blown into a ragged bundle of feathers by the wind, and struck the ground with a thump that was audible to the three watchers. Cameron gave the gun back to Peyton.
"How did you know you'd slug that bird?" demanded Peyton, almost angrily.
"Well, I feel which way the bullet goes," said Cameron. "I've hunted a good deal when every bullet had to be turned into a dead rabbit or a deer. You learn to feel just where the bullet is going." He made this speech with such a simplicity that all at once Peyton began to smile.
"All right, Cameron," he said. "I want you on this place. You are hired."
Hoofbeats swept up to the front of the house, paused, and almost at once there trampled into the room three big men. One of them was Will Tierney.
"There's a dance at Ripton," called out Tierney. "Going with me, Jack?"
Then his voice changed as he barked out,
"What's the idea of bringing Breeds home, Jack?"
"What do you mean?"
asked the girl. She cried it out and made a quick step away from Cameron.
"Breed," growled her father. "Have you got greaser in you, Cameron? By God, you have!"
Big Tierney and the other two men were striding closer.
"Throw him out," said Tierney. "Think of the gall of him coming out here. By God, think of it, Jack. What's the matter with you? Can't you see the smoke in the eye?"
Cameron looked not at all at this approaching danger. He considered the girl only, and saw her eyes widen with horror and disgust. She caught a hand to her breast as though she were struck to the heart by some memory. He knew what that memory was. It was their walk together up the road. It would stay in her mind now, like dirt ingrained in the skin. It would be a foulness in her recollection. Hands fell on him, but they could do nothing to him compared with the look in the great stricken eyes of the girl as she turned away from him. Then Cameron turned toward the others. The two tall, fair-haired men had something of the look of Jacqueline about them. They were her brothers, perhaps.
"Kick him out!" shouted one of them. "We don't want no damn Breeds here!"
"I'll leave the place and never come back," said Cameron. "But if you handle me, I'll return and kill you one by one, I swear to God."
"Do you hear him, the dirty half-breed?"
cried Tierney, and he struck Cameron across the mouth with the flat of his hand. They swept Cameron to the window and hurled him through it. He landed on his head and shoulders, rolled over, and came staggering to his feet.
"And if I have to look at you again," called Tierney, "I'll take a whip to you myself."
In a windswept ravine among the hills, the campfire blew aside, sharply slanting, fluttering the flames to blueness, making them shrink close to the sticks which were burning. The circle of blanketed figures around the fire was very dimly illumined. Young John Cameron, standing in the center of the circle, near the fire, could be seen more clearly. Instinct had made him select the leader of the party. He had to face the wind in order to look at the old man. He had to stiffen his lips and raise his voice against the blast. Sometimes he was almost shouting, and his breath was short as he came to the end. "I have told you everything. The white men kick me out of their way like dirt. The white women loathe me. Therefore I am not one of their people. If I am not a white man, then I am an Indian. Let me come with you." There was a slight turning of heads as all looked toward the old man. He rose, tapped the ashes out of his pipe, and stepped close to Cameron. He was very old. The million wrinkles on his face were like knife cuts, but the eyes, folded back behind drooping lids, were as bright as youth itself. He laid on the breast of Cameron the tip of a forefinger as hard as naked bone. "My son," he said, and the words blew with the wind and entered the mind of Cameron. "My son, when the heart is sick, men turn to new places, but they find no happiness except among their own kind. What is your kind? The white people will not have you, but you have an eye too open and wide. You are not an Indian. We cannot take you. You would bring new ways to us. You are neither white nor Indian. You must live your own life in your own world, or else you must fight the white men or the Indians until they take you in. All people are glad to have a man of whom they are afraid. Find the best man among many and ask him. He will tell you what to do." The wind was at the back of Cameron helping him, and it was still early night when he came again into the long, winding main street of the town of Gallup. Fire still burned in the forge of the blacksmith. He was still hammering at his anvil when the voice at his door made him look up and see the same agile, light form he had noticed that same morning. "Will you name the best man in Gallup?" Cameron was asking.
"The best man?" the blacksmith laughed. "Les Harmony is the best man, all right."
"Where shall I find him?"
"He's in the old Tucker house down the street. He moved in there the other day and unrolled his pack. Fourth house from the corner in the middle of the big lot."
Cameron found the place easily. His mind was weighted by the sense of a double duty. He had to find Will Tierney and make sure that Tierney was indeed the murderer of Wayland. But when he killed Tierney, it must not be as a sneaking manslayer, but as a man of accepted name and race. Les Harmony might be the man to tell him what to do. He had heard the name before, but he could not tell how or where. Wayland himself must have spoken of Harmony, but the name had always been attached to something great. He was an old man, no doubt, and loaded with the wisdom of the years. So Cameron tapped with a reverent hand at the door of the shack. A faint light seeped through the cracks in the flimsy wall.
"Come in!"
thundered a great voice. He pulled the door open and stepped inside. The wind slammed the door shut behind him because what he saw loosened the strength of his fingers. He never had seen such a man. He never had hoped to see one. Somewhere between youth and grayness, young enough to retain speed of hand and old enough to have his strength hardened upon him, Les Harmony filled the mind and the eye. He was not a giant in measured inches or in counted pounds, but he struck the imagination with a gigantic force. He was magnificent rather than handsome. The shaggy forelock and the weight of the jaw gave a certain brutality to his face, but the enormous power that clothed his shoulders and his arms was the main thing. His wrist was as round and as hard as an apple, filled with compacted sinews of power and the iron bone of strength underneath. He was eating a thick steak with a mug of coffee placed beside it. Gristler bone in the last mouthful crackled between his teeth now.
"Are you Les Harmony?" asked Cameron. The other nodded.
"I've come to ask you a question," said Cameron. He stepped closer to the table.
"You're Wayland's breed, ain't you?" asked the great voice.
Cameron stopped, stiffening suddenly.
"I don't talk to breeds. I don't have them in the same place with me. Get out," commanded Harmony.
"I go without talking," said Cameron, "like a dog."
"All breeds is dogs," said Harmony.
"Dogs have teeth," answered Cameron, and stepping still closer, he leaned and flicked his hand across the face of the giant. Harmony rose without haste. His eye measured several things: Cameron, and the distance to the door, which assured him that the victim could not escape. He leaned one great hand on the table, and in the other raised the mug of coffee, which he emptied at a draught. He wiped his dripping lips on the back of his hand as he put down the cup.
"I've come to ask a question, and I'll have your answer," said Cameron.
"I'll have it, if I have to tear it out of your throat."
Harmony did not walk around the table. He brushed it aside with a light gesture, and all the dishes on it made a clattering.
"You'll tear it out of me?"
he said softly, and then he lunged for Cameron. Up there in the mountain camps, patiently, with fists bare, Mark Wayland had taught his foster son something of the white man's art of self-defense. Cameron used the lessons now. He had no hope of winning, he only hoped that he might prove himself a man. Speed of foot shifted him aside from the first rush. He hit Harmony 3 times on the side of the jaw as the big target rushed past. It was like hitting a great timber with sacking wrapped over it. Harmony stopped his rush, turned. He pulled a gun and tossed it aside.
"I'm gonna kill you," he said through his teeth, "but I don't want tools to do the job. A greasy breed, a damned greasy breed to make a fool out of me, eh?"
He came again, not blindly, but head up, balanced, inside himself, as a man who understands boxing advances. Even if he had been totally ignorant, to stand to him would have been like standing to a grizzly, but he had skill to back up his power. He was fast, bewilderingly fast for a man of his poundage. He feinted with the left. He repeated with the same hand, and the blow grazed the head of Cameron. It was as though the hoof of a brass-shod stallion had glanced from his skull. The weight of the blow flung him back against the wall, and Harmony rushed in to grasp a helpless victim. His arms reached for nothingness. Cameron had slid away with a ducking sidestep. He had to look on his own fists as tack hammers. They would only avail if they hit the right place 1,000 times, breaking down some nerve center with repeated shocks. The swift blows thudded on the jaw of Harmony as he swayed around. He tried the left feint again, and the blow was sidestepped. Wings were under the feet of Cameron, and he felt them and used them. If only there were more room than the shack afforded, if only he had space to maneuver in, then he could swoop and retreat and swoop again, until he had beaten this monster into submission. But he had to keep a constant thought of the walls, the overturned chairs, the table which had crashed over on its side and extended its legs to trip him, and one slip, one fall, would be the end of him. Those dreadful hands of Harmony would break him in an instant, but every moment he was growing more sure, more steady. He changed from the jaw and shot both hands for the wind. His right thumped on the ribs, as on the huge round of a barrel, but the left dug deep into the rubbery stomach muscles, and Harmony grunted. A second target that made, and then he reached Harmony's glaring eyes with hooking punches that jarred back the massive head. He reached the wide mouth and puffed and cut the lips. They fought silently except for the noise of their gasping breath. And always there was the terrible danger that one of Harmony's blows would get fairly home. Then the devil that was lodged behind his eyes would have its chance at full expression. A glancing blow laid open the cheek of Cameron. He felt the hot running of the blood down his face. But that was nothing, nothing compared with the stake for which he fought. Not merely to endure for a time, but actually to win, to conquer, to beat this great hulk into submission. He fought for that. He never struck in vain. For the eyes, for the mouth, for the vulnerable side of the chin, or for the soft of the belly, those were his targets. A hammer stroke brushed across his own mouth, merely brushed across it, but slashed the lips open and brought a fresh downpouring of the blood. In return, he stepped aside and tattooed the body and then the jaw of Harmony. The big fellow was no longer an exhaustless well of energy, but now he paused between rushes. His mouth opened wide to take greater breath, sweat dripped down his face and mingled with the blood. But the flaming devil in his eyes was still bright. Exhaustion began to work in Cameron also. He had to run, to dance, to keep himself poised as on wings, and the preliminary tremors of weakness began to run through his body constantly. He saw that the thing would have to come to a crisis. He would have to bring it to an end, meet one of those headlong charges, and literally knock the monster away from him. It was impossible, but it was the only way. He saw the rush start, and he moved as though to leap to either side. Instead, he sprang in, ducked the driving fist that tried to catch him, and hammered a long overhand right straight against the jaw of Harmony. The solid shock, his running weight and lashing blow against the rush of Harmony, turned his arm numb to the shoulder. But Harmony was stopped. He was halted. He was put back on his heels. He was making little short steps to the rear to regain his balance. Cameron followed like a greedy wildcat. The right hand had no wits in it now. He used the left then, and with 3 full drives he found the chin of Harmony. He saw the great knees buckle, the head and shoulders swayed, the guarding, massive arms dropped first, and then Les Harmony sank to the floor. Cameron stepped back. He wanted to run in and crash his fist home behind the ear, a stroke that would end the fight even if Harmony were a giant. But there were rules in this game, and a fallen man must not be hit. So Cameron stood back,
groaning with eagerness, and saw the loosened hulk on its knees and on one supporting hand. "Have you got enough?" gasped Cameron.
"Me?" groaned Les Harmony. "Me enough? Damn your rotten heart!"
He lurched to his feet. Indignation seemed to burn the darkness out of his brain, and again he was coming in. Once more Cameron stepped in to check the rush. This time his fist flew high. His right shoulder was still aching from the first knockdown, and he felt the soggy impact against the enormous blackened cushion which covered the spot where the eyes of Harmody should have been shining. It was a hard blow, but it was not enough to stop Harmody. Before the eyes of Cameron loomed a great fist. He tried to jerk his head away from its path, but it jerked upward too swiftly. The shock seemed not under the jaw, but at the back of his head. He fell forward on his face. Consciousness came back to him after that in lurid flashes. He had a vague knowledge that told him he would be killed, certainly. He was dead already. It was his ghost that was wakening in another world. Then he was aware of lights around him, and the wide flash of a mirror's face. There were exclaiming voices. There was a greater voice than all others, the thunder of Les Harmody. A mighty hand upheld him, wavering. A powerful shoulder braced against him. He looked now and saw his own face dripping crimson, swollen, purple here and running blood there. He saw the face of Les Harmody beside his own, and the big man's features had been battered out of shape. On the left side there were no features. There was only a ghastly, swollen mass of bruised, hammered flesh. This monster was shouting out of a lopsided mouth. "Here's the fellow that stood up to me! Me, Les Harmody! By God, I thought that the time would never come when I'd have the pleasure of standing hand to hand with any one man! Look at him, you coyotes, you sneaking house dogs that run and yammer like hell when a wolf comes to town! Look at him! Here's plenty of wolf for you! Look at the skinny size of him that fought Les Harmody, man to man, and knocked me down! And then, by God, he stood back and gave me my chance to stand once more! I tell you, look at him, will you?" The big bandana of Harmody dipped into a schooner of beer. He drew it out, sopping, crushed the excess liquid out, and then carefully sponged the bleeding face of Cameron. The cold and the sting of the beer helped to rouse him completely.
"Speak up, one of you, do you see him?" thundered Harmody.
There was a murmur.
"Grady, you fat-faced buzzard, do you see him now? Is he a white man?"
"He's anything that you want to call him, Les."
"I ask you, is he white, damn you?"
"Sure, he's white, Les."
"The rat that ever calls him a breed again is going to have me to reckon with afterwards. No, he don't need no help. He can go by himself, but by God, he'll have fair play man to man. Listen, kid, are you feeling better? I wanted him to see you and what you done to me. I wanted the whole damn world to see. Kid, will you drink with me? Can you stand? Can you drink? Whiskey, Grady. Damn, you move fast. Whiskey for the kid. Here, fella, I've been searching the world for a gent with the nerve and the hands to stand up to me. Here's to the man that done it. Every one of you hombres, liquor up on this. Take a look at him. He's a man. He's a M-A-N. Drink to him. Bottoms up."
There was music in the Peyton house. Joe Peyton thrummed a banjo. Harry and Will Tierney sang. Jacqueline was at the piano, and her father, Oliver Peyton, composed himself in a deep chair with his hands folded behind his head, a contented audience. They had not heard the pounding hoofs of a big horse approach the house, but they were aware of the creaking of the floor in the hall as someone walked toward them, and now the great figure that loomed in the doorway silenced the song in the middle. Oliver Peyton jumped to his feet.
"Hey, Les Harmody," he called. "I'm glad to see you, old son. Come in and sit down. You know everybody. What you drinkin'?"
Harmody accepted the extended hand rather gingerly.
"Thanks, Ollie. I'm not drinking, and for what I've got to say, I reckon the standin'll be the best. Sorry to break in on you folks like this. Hello, Jacqueline. Hello, Will. Hello, everybody. Glad to see you. And sorry to see you, too."
"What's the matter, Les?"
urged Oliver Peyton, frowning anxiously.
"You talk as though you had a grudge, old-timer."
"By a way of speaking, I ain't got a grudge," said Harmody. "But in another way, I got a pretty deep one. I've come from a friend, and a better friend no man ever had. You know John Cameron?"
"The breed?"
asked Tierney. Harmony started.
"That's the wrong word for him, Will. I've stood up and told people the breed ain't the word for him, but maybe you weren't around when I did my talking. His grandmother was a Blackfoot girl that could have married a chief and done him proud. His father and all his line are as white as white, you understand?"
"Blood is blood," said Tierney calmly. "He's always a breed to me."
Harmony took in a big breath.
"We'll find a better place to argue it out one day," he said.
"Any place and any time would be good for me,"
said Tierney, and his bright eyes measured Harmony steadily.
"Quit it, Will," commanded Oliver Peyton. "It only riles up less, can't you see that? Less, I wish you'd sit down." "I'll say it standin'," answered Harmony. "I've been away in the hills for pretty near a month with Cameron. It takes time to learn to know a friend, but I've learned to know him. On a horse or on his feet, with his hands or with a gun, I never found a better man, but he's got ideas."
He paused when he said this and ran his eyes over the group, his glance dwelling for a moment on the face of the girl. She had grown pale.
"Jacqueline," said Harmony, "maybe you know what news I've got?"
"I can guess it," she answered.
Her father stared at her.
"I've done a lot of talking, and a lot of reasoning with him," went on Harmony, "but the main thing is that he feels he's given his word, and he's given it to God Almighty, so he'll keep it. Right here in this room he gave his promise."
"He did," said the girl through colorless lips.
"What promise?" asked Oliver Peyton.
"When Will and Joe and Harry had their hands on him, he told them that if they threw him out, he'd kill them. He swore to God that he would."
"What kind of damned rot is this?" demanded Oliver Peyton. "I heard that, too, but it's rot."
"Why, he's a crazy fool," declared young Joe Peyton.
"Harmony," said Oliver Peyton, "you mean to say that that fella, that man Cameron, that he's going to come on the trail of my boys?"
"He gave 'em fair warning," said Harmony. "There was three of 'em, and he gave 'em a fair warning not to handle him, and then they done it. I tell you, Ollie, a promise is a mighty sacred thing to that Cameron."
"There's a law," said the rancher, "and I'll have the sheriff and his men out."
"Hell, Oliver," said Harmony, "you might as well ask the sheriff and his boys to try and catch a wild hawk. I'm telling you the truth. They'll never see hide nor hair of him."
"You mean that the young snake is down here now?" shouted Peyton.
"He ain't near," replied Harmony. "The fact is that he's the kind that never hits below the belt. I've talked and argued with him. I've begged him to think it over, because a killing is most usually murder in the eyes of the law. But he can't get it out of his head that he's made a promise to God Almighty to kill the three of 'em. Arguing won't budge him." Then he added, "But he wants you all to be warned fair and square that he's a-coming after you. You'll kill him, or he'll kill you."
This struck a silence across the room. Harmony went on.
"You are the special one, Tierney, and he mostly wants to have the killing of you, because he says that you sure killed his partner over at their mine."
"He's a madman," said Tierney. "Accusing me of murder, eh? All that a mad dog can see is red."
"He says that there was around 50 pounds in gold dust, and he points out that inside the last 10 days you've made a payment on the land where you're going to live with Jacqueline yonder. You've made that payment."
"I don't follow all of this,"
exclaimed Tierney loudly.
But Harmony said, "You can't drown me out till I've made my point. You made that payment with 30 pounds of the same sort of gold dust."
"Will!"
cried the girl.
"You damn sneaking blackguard!" shouted Tierney.
He strode at Harmony, but Oliver Peyton stepped between and stopped the younger man.
"I know that you're a mighty brave and bright young man, Will," said Peyton. "But don't you start anything with Les Harmony. He's just too old and tough to be chawed up by youngsters."
Harmony backed up to the door.
"I come in here being sorry that I had to bring bad news," he said. "But the longer I've stayed here, the more I've felt that the kid is right. There's something damn rotten in the air, Tierney. I think the kid is right about you, and if you've done that job, God help your soul."
He was gone through the doorway at once. Behind him, Tierney was saying,
"Something has to be done about this. A skunk like that Breed going about the county, poisoning the air with his lies."
"Will," said the girl, "is it a lie?"
He spun about on his heel and confronted her and her white face.
"Jack, are you believing him?"
he shouted. She stared at him for a moment.
"I don't know," she said. "I don't know what to believe except that John Cameron is an honest man."
She saw everything clearly. It would be a battle of 3 against 1, and poor John Cameron must die unless Harmony threw in with him. Even so, that meant a battle. There was one way to stop the fighting. That was to induce Cameron to leave the country, and if she could find the way to him. This thought got her out of the room at once. In the corral she caught up her favorite mare and was quickly on the road. Far away, north on the trail or south on the trail, east or west on it,
or more likely wandering straight across country, Big Les Harmony was traveling now. She turned in the saddle with a desperate eagerness, scanning the horizon, and so made out, very dimly, the movement of a shape over a hill and against the horizon. She struck out in that direction at once. It was the eastern trail, and she flew the mare along it for half a mile. After that she slowed to a walk and heard distinctly, out of the distance, the clacking of hooves over a stretch of stony ground. She would have to go very carefully. She would have to hunt like an Indian if she wished to trail this man and remain unheard. As she came up the next rise, it seemed to her that she heard other hoofbeats behind her, but that was no doubt a sheer mental illusion or a trick of echoes. Before her, in the night, there was no longer sound or sight of the big horseman. She pressed on at a gallop, giving up all hope of secrecy in her pursuit.
"Les!" she began to cry aloud. "Les Harmody!"
A deep-throated shout answered her at once. She saw the huge man and the huge horse looming against the stars of the next hummock.
"That you, Jacqueline?" asked Harmody as she came up. "What's wrong?"
"Nothing much," she answered. "Cameron is after my two brothers. He'll probably kill them or they'll kill him, and that won't make me any richer."
"What do you want to do?" he asked.
"I want to beg John to leave the country."
"It's no use," said Harmody. "He won't go."
"I want to try, though. I have to try to persuade him."
"Do you like Cameron?"
"I like him a lot."
"Come along, then. A woman can always do what a man can't manage. I've begged him hard to give up this job. He's been like a stone, though."
I'm afraid we're going to have to save the end of this story until next week. Thanks for joining me this week. This is Samantha Dickens, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by the Coronavirus Update at 1. Recording Library of West Texas produces weekly podcasts in association with Centers. Join Centers Dr. Christy Edwards and licensed therapist Melanie Seitz, along with your host, Recording Library's Executive Director, Bailey Hennis, as they feature guests and discuss how to cope in the age of COVID-19. These programs present information about mental health and include tips on dealing with anxiety, isolation, worry, and more. Topics include mental exercises you can practice to become calm and relaxed, ideas on things to do during this time, information specific to seniors, and other related topics. The Center's COVID-19 podcasts, Tuesdays at 11 a.m., Wednesdays at 7 p.m., and Fridays at 5 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. You can also access these podcasts on demand at centerstx.org.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 89 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-80s. Then tomorrow, clear with a high around 102. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-80s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
It's time for the Noon Book Hour. Readings of books from all genres, handpicked by staff at the Recording Library of West Texas. Hachette Audio presents The Last Trial, written by Scott Turow, read by John Bedford Lloyd. 34. Donatella's News. Kirill and Donatella have lived for 2 decades in an English manor house in Greenwood County, with steep slate mansards. Within, it is appointed in the tone of a British barony, with lustrous antiques of chestnut and cherry, long velvet drapes in scarlet, and sterling pieces heavy enough to double as murder weapons. Despite Donatella's Italian bloodlines, her Anglophilic decoration is in the style of the Argentine upper class, which gravitated toward English mannerisms in the 19th century as a way to repudiate the influence of Spain. Stern has been here several times before for the huge holiday parties that the Pafkos hosted. It was just the kind of scene that pleased Kirill, a confluence of many of Kendall County's most influential citizens. Although interesting would be the word Kirill would prefer. Pauls, musicians, many figures from Easton and the U, artists, business leaders.